Stand, please. Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 10-1305. This is Brown v. L. Petition for Securities and Exchange Commission. Mr. Scalia, the petitioner, Mr. Quinn, your boss.
Morning, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. The Securities and Exchange Commission has a special, heightened responsibility under the securities laws to consider the effects of its rules on efficiency, competition, and capital formation. This court repeatedly has said that includes an obligation for the commission to apprise itself and the public of the economic consequences of its regulations. But in this case, over the dissent of two commissioners, the commission has replicated the error that caused this court in two prior cases to invalidate SEC rules. As in the Chamber of Commerce Mutual Fund Governance case, and as in the American Equity Annuities case, the commission has again entirely failed to ascertain certain costs of its action, failed to quote this court, do as best it can to apprise other costs, and it has failed to adequately apprise the costs and benefits of its regulation in light of the other regulations that exist in this space, including Delaware law and a new rule adopted by the commission at the same time, Rule 14A8. This court should vacate these rules because these are serious errors that go to the very rationale given for the agency action, and because there will be no disruption in removing this deeply flawed rule, even as other superior alternatives go into effect, namely, again, Delaware Section 112 and Rule 14A8, which was adopted at the same time.
You're not challenging that latter rule.
We are not challenging 14A8. That's the rule that gives the shareholders the ability to decide through a 14A8 proxy proposal whether they want this cost placed on the company and think it brings benefits worth it.
But they had that as a right already under state law.
It was recently clarified by Delaware in 2009 to be a right under state law. There had been some question about that. So, Your Honor, what you have is within a year of the SEC's action, you have Delaware stepping in and saying shareholders can amend the bylaws in this manner. It's okay. And you have the SEC contemporaneous with amending, or rather adding Rule 14A11, you have the SEC saying, and here's an added way you can get there. I'd like to focus on three particular respects in which the agency's cost analysis was flawed. First, the frequency of these election contests. The frequency with which these contests would occur is obviously fundamental to ascertaining the burden that they will impose. When it suited its interests, the commission claimed that there would be a high frequency of election contests under these rules. Of course, the very purpose of proposing these was the claim that proxy contests, traditional proxy contests, are insufficiently accessible, and that something that was could be used, quote, more easily, quote, that would, quote, eliminate a collective action problem, quote, and that otherwise would be easier to use, more accessible, and not, quote, prohibitively expensive, quote. The commission said this was needed to address that problem. And at page A90, that's page 90 of our appendix, the commission actually relied on rulemaking comments to claim that this proposal would be used a great deal of the time. It relied in footnote 824 on one estimate that 15% of companies would get a proxy access proposal under these rules every year. That's more than 800 companies a year.
Is this the final rule or they had noticed?
This is the final rule, Your Honor, where at page A90, in a footnote, they relied upon a study, a survey, which had been done, which said that 15% of companies would get an election contest proposal under these rules in 2011 alone. It also cited a statement by my client, the Chamber of Commerce, where the Chamber said that these new election contests would become, quote, customary, quote. So this is what the commission said when it was claiming benefits for its action. Yet when it claimed came to costs, it did an about-face and claimed instead that this mechanism would be far less accessible. And I want to emphasize.
Go ahead, finish your emphasis, and then I'll ask you.
My emphasis is that the means by which they got there was to purport to compare the accessibility of this new mechanism with the existing traditional proxy contest, and to surprisingly claim that its new mechanism was harder to use than the supposedly prohibitively expensive proxy contest. That was arbitrary and capricious on its own terms, and all the more so because elsewhere in its release, when convenient, the commission claimed this would be used with great frequency.
I'm looking for the something at the call for note 824 to which you referred, but I'm not finding what it is that you want to look at here.
It's 872 on page A90.
Well, I'm not using your
it's
imagination.
It's Federal Register 56. Yeah. 756. And I'll quote in the text, they say, this is in the third column in the footnote at the bottom beneath it, quote, "The comments that we received regarding the likely increase in the number of election contests resulting from the new rules seem to undercut this view and suggest instead that shareholders' behavior may indeed be influenced by the rules." So they're claiming there will be high use based on the comments, and then they cite the things that I just mentioned in support of their action. The second deficiency in the agency's cost analysis that I want to emphasize is its treatment of state law. Repeatedly, the commission claimed that the costs that this rule would impose were associated with state law rights to nominate and elect directors, and I'm going to quote, and that they were, quote, "are not costs incurred for including shareholder nominees for director in the company's proxy materials," end quote. So they didn't just say these costs were associated with state law. They went on to make clear that in their view, they are not costs incurred, quote, because of the rule. That's plainly wrong. It's exactly the type of error that caused this court to invalidate the commission's rule in the Chamber of Commerce case. Mm-hmm. And incidentally, they said it was important. Under this court's National Fuel Gas Supply decision, if an agency offers multiple rationales for its action, and this court can't be certain it would have done the same thing absent one of those flawed rationales, it will vacate. When an agency comes to you, repeatedly relies upon something, and tells you it is important, and that rationale is so deeply flawed, that is reason alone to vacate the rule. This affects their application of the rule both to operating companies and also the application of the rule to investment companies and mutual funds. Finally, with respect to costs, the commission failed to make any estimate at all of the single greatest cost imposed by this rule, and that is the election contest that will result, in which one commenter estimated would be $14 million and another estimated would be $11 million, although there was an estimate that was lower, although not small.
Was that for a particular contest or an aggregate figure?
Commenters had identified particular contests that they personally had experienced and said these were our costs.
So did you submit what, in your view or that of some commentator, was the aggregate cost?
Not of the entire rule, but commenters did indicate what they believed these election costs would be. They said it would be extremely costly. They identified these figures to substantiate, and the commission didn't say those figures were right or wrong. It reached no estimate at all, which again was the problem that it committed in both the Chamber of Commerce case and American Equity. No estimate. And then it compounded its error by proceeding to identify unsubstantiated circumstances in which it claimed that those costs might be minimized. And a repeated error it made was to identify things that might happen and might have an effect without saying how likely it was those things would happen or the magnitude of the effect. And the particularly egregious error here was that one thing that they said would minimize the greatest direct costs of these rules was the prospect that a board of directors exercising their fiduciary duties would identify a candidate, have an inclination toward that candidate, look at a potential access nominee, which would have to be submitted to them in advance, decide, no, we like our candidate more, put their candidate forward knowing that there would be an election contest, and then all of a sudden, in the commission's words, the directors would determine that they had, quote, no good faith purpose, quote, to support the poor fellow that they had decided to put forward for nomination and have attacked by the dissident shareholders.
Well, that's possible, right? They could say, the board could say, A, we think is a little better than B. We're going with A. Thank you for your suggestion. But if you're going to, if it's going to be contested, it's not worth $10 million of the shareholders' money to defend the difference.
Two responses to that, Judge Ginsburg. I think both are important. First, there is no record evidence of that happening.
No, I just said that's not impossible. They're saying it may happen, and it could
not happen. Impossible. Yeah. unlikely. They didn't estimate how unlikely or likely it would be. But even more important, that wasn't what they said. They said the directors would conclude that their fiduciary duties barred them from supporting their own nominee.
Stating, do we spend $10 million of shareholder money on this? It's not always going to be worth it. And that's as a fiduciary spoken.
$10 million perhaps. But again, it was their job to come in, determine how frequently this would occur and the magnitude of any potential cost savings. But it's speculative. It contradicted extensive record rulemaking evidence.
Anything that they supplied to meet this deficiency you're claiming would be speculative because we've never had this situation, right? They'd have to be saying, well, 80% of the time the board will continue to oppose, let's say, the proxy candidate, the dissident candidate, and perhaps 20% not. And they're going to have to extrapolate that from something, but there's no experience with it.
There is experience with election contests, and they could have examined how frequently it occurs that a candidate is put forward by a company in a traditional proxy contest, and they don't support their own nominee. It doesn't happen, but they could have looked into it.
Well, but by your own account, there are going to be more such candidacies in the future because it's less costly to do this, right? So there will be more people who are not utterly at odds with management may be putting forth candidates in the future, whereas in the past it may have been something only people who are truly dissidents were doing.
But, Your Honor, this rule creates a special opportunity and incentive for the company to go ahead and even accept that candidate as their own, which is not something that's specified in the existing proxy rules. So their counterbalancing influences, they should have taken them into account. I'd like to emphasize additionally, as a separate related failure, the Commission's failure to adequately consider alternatives to what it was adopting. Because its assessment of cost and benefits was flawed, it necessarily failed also in assessing whether existing and new alternatives were comparable and sufficient, namely, again, the Delaware provision we've talked about, another Delaware provision that enables shareholders to reimburse successful dissident nominees for their expenses, or the 14A amendment.
In your brief, at your footnote 4 is 32.
This is the opening brief?
Yes. You draw on threatened proxy contests found statistically significant, this is a study, statistically significant negative returns on investment value of nearly 20% in the 24 months following the announcement of a contested election at the 27 firms where dissidents won board seats. And then you say there's another study that tends to confirm that, the NERA study. Those contests, I believe, I should ask you, they may have involved situations in which there was a change of control in the offing. That's to say, where the contest reflected a potential change of control.
That's correct.
Okay. That's not implicated in this new rule, correct? I mean, these candidates have to certify they're not the entering wedge of a...
That's correct. This rule is different in that regard, okay. Your Honor.
So studies about unstaggering boards and so on really are quite irrelevant.
Not entirely irrelevant. Their relevance...
They open the company up to... They remove some hostile takeover defenses and have a different effect.
They would bear on it. The Commission certainly considered studies of that nature. And the studies that it used on hybrid boards, it admitted that those studies had data that was, it said, quote, difficult to interpret, quote, and it admitted that some of the results could be explained by random chance.
That's the Cernich study in particular, I think.
Exactly, which they sort of relied on but admitted had many flaws. Finally, with respect to...
Well, they relied on it. In one place,
that's right.
Another place, but they acknowledge that there are some flaws.
That's correct, Your Honor. Finally, with respect to alternatives, the Commission has estimated that as between Delaware's provision on the one hand and the new 14A8 provision on the other hand, companies will receive 190 proposals a year to have their governing documents amended to permit proxy access. I would submit it was more reasonable for the Commission to stand back, look at this change in the existing legal terrain, and then recognize that to be part of the status quo as against which it had to measure its rule.
Well, it may have been more reasonable, but that doesn't mean it was arbitrary and capricious not to do it.
But going forward, Your Honor.
There are an array of options that you've put forward here, but the only question is whether the one they chose was arbitrary and capricious.
That's correct in that regard. Although, going forward, if there are going to be 190 of these incidents a year, the Commission has ample opportunity to assess whether, in fact, it is easy to amend the bylaws in this manner, or whether instead shareholders are saying...
When did Delaware clarify this?
2009.
When in 2009?
It went into effect in August.
And when did this rule...
the rule was proposed in June.
The record had already closed at that point?
I don't believe the record had closed, but I also think there's been a lot of waiting to see what would happen with this rule before some of these new mechanisms were used.
Any post-record evidence?
Not that we're aware of. Finally, these rules violate the First Amendment. These are neither a disclosure requirement. They are plainly not commercial speech because they do not propose a commercial transaction.
You have a choice between your First Amendment argument and your rebuttal time.
I'll save the remaining time for rebuttal. Thank you.
How much time do we have left? You don't have any left to speak of anyways. We have the First Amendment argument on brief, and if we get into it much with the opposing counsel, we'll add a little to the... I'm going to give you back some rebuttal time. We'll give you a little more if we get into the First Amendment. Okay. I will hear from the respondent.
Good morning. Randall Quinn for the SEC. Your Honor, the Commission's consideration here fully complied with this Court's prior decision in Chamber 1. The Commission considered the relevant factors that affect the potential economic consequences of the rule. And let me just directly go to the specific points that petitioner has raised. The question of the frequency. The Commission needed to come up with an estimate of the frequency. The Commission looked at the number of proxy contests and the number of shareholder proposals relating to board issues. The Commission then discounted that, and again, this is an estimate, discounted that because of the very significant thresholds here, which are important to keep in mind. This rule cannot be used by a shareholder or a group unless they own 3% of the company's voting securities for three years.
This was a change from the proposed rule.
This was a change from the...
So the increased holding period meant a diminution in the number of likely contests.
Yes, Judge Ginsburg.
And did you have empirical data on the holdings, the length of period of time that people who had launched such contests in the past had held their shares?
We did not have data on that. But again, what the Commission looked at...
Isn't that available?
I'm not sure if that's...
Well, Williams Act filings would have given you 5% threshold data, right? And holding
period. The Commission considered data about in the threshold about the 1%, 3%, 5%, and so on. So we had data as to how that will affect the availability. As to the length of time, the data is necessarily incomplete. But to complete my point about the estimate, so the Commission looked at these factors and then needed to discount them in some significant way to account for the thresholds. I think it's important to keep in mind petitioner's point about proposals, the potentially large number of proposals to change proxy access. Under the shareholder proposal rule, someone who owns $2,000 worth of shares for 1 year can make a proposal. So it's certainly rational to conclude that threshold is much lower. There could very well be more proposals to change the system than there can be persons who meet a 3% three-year threshold. So that's why the number of anticipated proposals relating to this issue is significantly greater than the estimate of the number of times that shareholders will actually be able to put forth a shareholder nominee.
Let's see if we can put some numbers on the table. I believe the Commission reported that there had been 68 contests of this sort during a prior period?
I believe it was 57. We could double check that because it was...
It seemed to me that the numbers went from 68 to a projected 51. Does that ring a bell?
What I think happened was I believe that it was 57 solicitations plus 118 proposals relating to the board. Well, that total was 175, discounted by 75% led to 51.
On directors, not on board changes. Okay, just looking at directors.
Judge Smith, just to clarify, there are two things here. There are contests, and there are shareholder proposals relating to board governance.
The numbers we're interested in now is for the contest.
Right. I can't find the exact page. I believe that was 57. That was based on the number of contests relating to
57 was the number in 2009.
In 2009.
So 57 director contests, right? Under the old regime. Mm-hmm. The new regime is designed to make this easier, less costly, not without limitation, but for those who meet the thresholds, right?
Estimate it's going to go down in number from the adoption of rules designed to make it easier and less costly.
If I could clarify, I think a big
key
picture.
If the answer to that is yes, then we have a problem.
Well, the answer to that, I will answer that, but first, as a preface, we need to consider the big picture here. The rationale of the rule is to make the federal proxy process a better approximation of shareholder rights that they have at a meeting. And that rationale really, really hasn't been disputed. Then we come to a question of the cost and benefits. Will it be easier? Will it be harder? And so on. So I don't see that there's a contradiction here. One of the important things...
There may or may not be. It depends on the numbers. The question is, if you have made it easier to launch a contest, have you also predicted there will be fewer or more contests under the new regime?
There will be fewer contests because the threshold requirements are different.
Now, wait a minute. The people who don't meet the threshold requirement can still bring a traditional contest, right?
Correct.
Those who do can switch over and avail themselves of the new rule. Okay? So there's no reason for that number to go up or down. New people who might not have brought a contest if they didn't have the new rule will now enter the market, as it were. They could also do. So why won't the number go up? Why would it go down?
And in answering that, tell us where the commission has explained the answer to that question.
I think the discussion of the frequency, I believe, is on Federal Register pages 56,743 to 744. Judge Ginsburg, what I'm trying to express is that if you're comparing 57 contests as to which there is no threshold requirement, someone owns one share for however long they want, they can launch a contest. You're comparing that to a rule that makes a shareholder meeting more like, makes the proxy more like the shareholders. But under the rule, there are very high thresholds. So
the holder that doesn't meet the threshold could still bring the same contest that they could before. You're not eliminating any rights that they had under which they brought the 57. So the question we have is how do you come up with a lower number when you are expanding the universe of contests that can be brought?
Is that what the commission has done? It's predicted a lower number under the going forward.
That the commission estimate is that the companies will receive 51 shareholder nominees, and yes, that is lower than the number of proxy contests.
Now, would that be in addition to an expectation that the 57 pre-regulation type contest would continue? Or is the commission asserting that these would be in substitution for the total of 57 before?
Well, Judge Santelli, it would not be in substitution because I think the point was just made. The people that meet the thresholds to use 14A11 will also meet the whatever threshold there might be to launch a proxy contest.
So the real expectation would not be 51. It would be some number possibly as high of 100, as 108, assuming constancy, possibly as high as 108, or less if you have some switchable proxy fights in between. But 51 is not the target number, right? It's actually some number of 51 plus traditional contests, right?
Judge Santel, 51 is the commission's estimate of the number of shareholders or groups who will use Rule 14A11.
Okay. And others will not be able to use the new rule, and they'll have to decide whether to proceed under the old rule.
Correct.
And the total will still be 51. No?
Not the total number of proxy contests. Let me try to clarify this.
The 51 does not include people who are going to proceed under the old rule, who fail to meet the thresholds but go forward anyway.
Judge, no, it's the number of people using the rule because it's part of the commission's analysis of what are the consequences of this rule.
Right, okay.
Judge Brown?
Does the commission's analysis include not just those who already meet that 3% three-year threshold, but people who could form groups to meet the threshold? Because the commission makes the point that they want to make that easier.
Yes, the commission, several places in the analysis, makes the point, in fact, that it's likely that groups will need to be formed. There is a number in here that approximately one-third of companies, we estimate, have one or more shareholders who meets the 3% requirement. So that means two-thirds do not, and the commission discussed in several places how groups might be formed. The commission made some adjustments in its rules, in the proxy rules, to, in fact, facilitate the formation of groups, to relax some prohibitions.
If that's true, then we go back to Judge Ginsburg's question, which is how is the number going down?
But the number of total proxy contests isn't necessarily going down because we will have, if in 2009 we have, I don't know how many we'll have, we will have, say we were in 2009 and the rule was in effect, we would have 57 plus the additional shareholders or groups who could take advantage, who could use 14A11. So again, I think, or I hope this supports my main point, is that the commission considered what are the economic consequences of this rule. How does this rule change things? And that's why we have a 51, which is less than 57, and frankly, we don't know for sure what the total will be going forward under a regime where you both have traditional proxy contest and you have 14A11 as an additional avenue.
Okay, but it would seem at least likely that it'll be greater than 57.
I think that certainly, yes, that's likely.
51 under the new rule, however many hang on under the old rule.
Okay. Yes, that's right. Turning to a second point that petitioner.
So what about the, well, maybe this is your second point, but the, how many did you assume in calculating, or maybe you didn't, the costs of this new rule?
That's the 51 estimate. That's the estimate. It's, as we tried to explain in our brief, it's one of many factors that the commission looked at as to both cost and benefits, but that is the estimate that we came up with. What I was going to get to was the point about the cost to companies of waging a proxy contest under this rule, and the commission did provide a range. It's in the release. The commission, in essence, accepted the range submitted by commenters, 4 to 14 million for larger companies and other numbers for smaller companies.
Where's that in the decision?
Those numbers are there. They're cited. They are cited in our brief. They're not at the top of my head, but we point out specifically in our brief, those numbers are in the commission's release, accepting that this is a range of potential costs for an election contest. And it was reasonable for the commission to also point out that not every board will decide that they need to wage a contest fighting a shareholder nominee. So that was addressed.
Why would that be? Why would the board, having chosen one person, decide not to oppose another one?
The board could conclude that the shareholder nominee is, in essence, of a similar qualifications. Perhaps a shareholder nominee has different strengths and weaknesses than the board nominee. Now, the board has to make a decision. Is it consistent with our fiduciary duty to spend money opposing a shareholder nominee? I think in the commission acknowledged, in many cases, boards will conclude that the board's nominee is better, and they will oppose. In some cases, the board can reasonably conclude, consistent with its fiduciary duty, that we don't need to spend company funds because the shareholders have nominated someone who is.
Is there any experience under the old rule with boards not opposing an outside contestant, candidate?
Jesse's right. I don't know the answer to that. I don't think that's discussed. I think
so we know that large companies are spending around up to $11 million to oppose dissident candidates. And we don't know that they ever just roll over.
I don't have any number on that.
But you're projecting that under the new rule, they'll roll over some of the time. So what's the difference that would cause that to happen?
I wouldn't describe it as rolling over. The difference is that there is a body of case law that says that a director, the board can't spend company funds for no good faith corporate purpose.
That's a constant. We can't explain a variable by a constant. That fiduciary duty exists now, and it will exist then.
Yes, Judge Ginsburg, I think the point the commission is making is it's reasonable to expect that in some situations the shareholder nominee will be sufficiently qualified that a board will not oppose it.
You know that's never occurred under the Hachon regime.
Judge, it probably has. I don't know how often.
You know it's never occurred, but it's reasonable to assume it will.
There's no record evidence that it ever occurred, right?
I don't believe it's been discussed in the record, but just until I
think it has ever occurred, shouldn't we not have expected a board that is not acting arbitrarily and capriciously to have considered that evidence? You're saying it may have occurred. You certainly have, the commission certainly has not told us that in the regulation. It seems to be taking out of the thin air the proposition that this would occur. We all understand the general duty of boards to act as fiduciaries, but again, that is a constant. That's not changing. So if the commission is projecting the behavior that you're describing and that they describe of the board folding and not opposing a shareholder nominee, what attempt was made to find out if that's happened in the past? And where would we find reference to that in the regulation?
I believe it's discussed in the sense of this is certainly a reasonable, possible outcome of what might happen.
I'll take the possible. The reasonable part, I'm not sure how the commission has supported.
Well, I see my time is up.
A theoretical possibility and a reasonable possibility.
Is there something about the more open access that would elicit, that the commission says will elicit a somehow different crop of candidates that might therefore get board acquiescence?
Well, one aspect.
The petitioners, of course, say just the opposite, right? That's opening the door to people who have very narrow special interests.
Well, Judge, one aspect that the commission does focus on is if we're limiting this to someone who's owned 3% of the company for 3 years, then that's someone who has a significant stake in the company. I think that supports the reasonableness of that not every potential nominee from that type of shareholder group is going to be, you know, so deficient that the boards will always oppose it. I think that's
well,
a reasonable.
If you looked at contests under the old rule, did you find that they were often launched or ever launched by people who would meet the thresholds?
I don't believe that was discussed. The question is, what was the ownership of people who were launching traditional proxy contests?
The percentage ownership, you mean?
The percentage ownership.
You just didn't have information, I guess, on the duration.
That was not discussed in the release, but
it wasn't discussed. So you don't know if you didn't have information because you didn't necessarily look for it.
That's true, Justice Ginsburg, but I don't. If I could finish my thought, I see my time is up. But again, I don't see how that would change the analysis of the commission making a predictive judgment.
Well, if the analysis is based on a predictive behavior that includes as a foundational element the amount of shares that are held by persons taking the action, then why would it not be relevant to have examined what the behavior of such shareholders was in the past?
Judge Santel, I fair my opinion stuff. I think it's there was enough here for the commission to make a reasonable judgment. We're talking about something very narrow. The commission has provided a range of costs on one factor. The commission has discussed many, many benefits of the rule, some of which petitioners do not even challenge. Then we're looking at the commission's discussion about this cost possibly might be reduced in some instances if certain behaviors happen. So I guess the sum of my answers would be that based on what we have here is reasonable, and even if you accept it, even if you look at the high range of this, the commission made a conclusion. Overall, the potential benefits of this rule justify the potential cost, and the commission set forth what all those costs might be.
Well, it set in very general terms range. In some cases, yes.
In some cases, it had specific costs. In some cases, it had a range of costs. And in some cases, it discussed possible alternate outcomes.
Most of these, except for the trivial things, printing and so on, they're not quantified. They're just enumerated as costs or benefits.
The commission acknowledged that many of them could not easily be quantified. We've just been talking about a range of costs that is quantified. In other words, I would say that is sufficient quantification for the commission to discuss a range of costs as part of its analysis of overall do benefits justify cost.
Just to go back a half step to where you were with Chief Judge Santel, the petitioners are telling us that this new regime will be used often, perhaps even by labor union pension funds and state employee pension funds, that they are substantial and long-term shareholders and would meet their thresholds. And they also tell us that those shareholders have different interests than shareholders at large, because they're also operating their capacity as employees, well, typically as employees, and that therefore you are facilitating challenges by people who are less likely than the average shareholder to have the broad interest of the company at heart. What did the commission say to that?
The commission did address that. The commission recognized the potential cost of that. The commission said, one, that there is a potential benefit here of boards being more responsive to shareholders who own a significant stake in the company. And second,
you mean these particular shareholders?
I mean, the general concern is, at this point, is shareholders seeking some sort of concession that would be bad for the company, either by threatening
for the shareholders, for that
right.
group of shareholders.
Right.
For the company.
And so the commission did acknowledge that, pointed out that there's a potential benefit here of a board being responsive to shareholders, and the commission also said
to all shareholders or to those narrow shareholders?
To those narrow shareholders who...
Why is that a benefit?
This group of shareholders might have ideas that would benefit the company
as
a whole.
Just
so
open,
we're not accepting
just
their premise.
Open to them, not necessarily responsive in the sense of...
Judge Ginsburg, the other thing
conceding.
Is... Let me try that. The other thing that the commission did say was that the 3% three-year threshold will certainly reduce the possibility of these groups seeking to advance their interests that are contrary to other shareholders, because that would mean that they are promoting some policy that would negatively affect shareholder value. And if I could just give you some numbers to put this into context, which... If you look at the S&P 500, which is about 75% of the value of U.S. equities, the average market capitalization of an S&P 500 company is about $23 billion. We have a rule that has a 3% threshold. So a shareholder or group would need to have a $700 million stake in a company for 3 years. And the commission's point is that would seem to make it unlikely that that shareholder or group would be seeking concessions from the company that will damage the company value, which will be damaging their own investment. It's possible.
Give me the numbers again. What's the average capitalization?
It's about $23
billion. $23 billion.
And we have a, if I've done the math right, we have a 3% threshold.
$7 billion.
And there can be intricacies in doing these numbers. But so approximately a $700 million stake for 3 years. And the commission pointed out that would reduce this possibility, which we acknowledge.
Group involved would have to have the...
an individual or a group.
Yeah.
And if I could briefly follow up on that, another aspect of this is if a group is formed, not every participant in the group won't necessarily have this one narrow interest that petitioners sort of postulate as a...
Who votes the shares of an employer stock ownership plan?
I believe that the trustee of the plan does.
And under the, can that trustee be a joint management union arrangement?
Just, I don't know the answer to that. I would say that, that there would be a, there's also a fiduciary duty here where an invest, someone managing these investment funds has a duty not to be promoting policies that will damage the value of the investment.
Well, so what do we know about, it's a lot of money, $700 million invested for 3 years. What do we know, it's a lot of money to me and to you perhaps, but what, I don't know that it's a lot of money to CalPERS. So what do we know about the distribution of their parade of horrible type people owning 3% of shares? Do we know anything about it?
Well, yeah, then the statistics are in the are in the amicus brief, but basically I think on average even one of these very large funds owns less than 1%. So again, that
average isn't going to help us here, right? It's the distribution. You know that an average could be reflect two very extreme polar points.
What is discussed in the amicus brief is that their calculations were in most instances, if you took the five largest institutional investors in a company, that still would not get you to the 3% threshold. Again, that's in their amicus brief. I don't know the underlying numbers there.
So the commission's answer to their reasoning was this just isn't likely to happen. That type of shareholder isn't likely to qualify.
That's part of the answer. I do not want to minimize the answer that this could be a benefit. The commission, you know, considered very carefully this question of how will this rule affect board performance and shareholder value, the rule overall. And the commission discussed at length various studies.
It's not going to have any effect because hardly anybody could ever qualify to use it, at least at an S&P 500 average company.
The commission, two answers, Judge Ginsburg. Some people will, and the commission did. The commission say that the availability of the rule, the fact that directors may be less insulated from removal in an election, is a benefit. No, that's a disputed evidentiary point,
well,
and that's what the commission...
a benefit in terms of the market for corporate control, but these people have to certify they're not interested in a change of control, right?
That's true, but the commission said that having a director who's come to the company through this process, just one director, the commission found, looking at studies, could be a benefit to board performance and shareholder value. And I think that judgment of the commission should be respected based on its consideration. The commission considered both sides of this debate, and that's...
I'm just wondering how you're going to get even 51 entities able to use this rule if, at least at a large company. Maybe the answer is it won't be at large companies.
Smaller than average companies.
I think at large companies with serious problems with board performance, a group may form. At some smaller companies, again, this is back to, I suppose, if I could sum up, we don't know for sure what the economic consequences will be. I believe the commission considered the relevant factors and provided an answer that's within the range of reasonableness.
A general question, not real general. Petitioners point out, and I noted from the record, that the commission has repeatedly referred to cost as being cost of state rights under state law, not as being a cause of this regulation. Isn't the commission ignoring the apparent fact that cost of the assertion of these rights is going to go up? So shouldn't that be attributed as a cost of the regulation rather than as a cost of the underlying state threat? Sort of approximate cause question, I guess.
Yeah, Judge Sentel, the commission did consider that very thing. The commission, in setting out the framework here, pointed out, and it is correct, that if there were not a state law right to nominate and elect, then you wouldn't have some of these costs that they point to. But the commission did not stop there. In every instance, as we detailed in our brief, and I can't summarize all, but we detailed in every instance, the commission discussed those very costs. So it is not an alternative rationale of state laws to blame, you know, and we'll consider the cost. It's a correct observation. Some costs arise because of state law. We, the commission, have considered all those costs, and here's why we're, you know,
going
forward.
One very esoteric question that I only thought of while Judge Ginsburg was discussing with you. Are there any of these large holders' employee plans for state employees where the vote is cast by elected state officials?
I don't know.
Okay. I said it was esoteric. I only thought of it at the last minute, so. I won't blame you for not knowing. I think your time has, we've now used up, I think, 30 minutes of your original 15.
If the court has no further questions.
If there are no further questions, then thank
you,
counsel.
I guess we were having a good time. It's just, it went fast.
Time flies when, go on. We'll give back 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Judge Brown, in response to your question, on page 11 of our reply brief, we explain that in estimating frequency, the commission considered only the aspects of its rule that it thought would constrain access to the proxy and declined to consider formation of groups, or rather failed to, as well as other ways that there would be increased access. So again, it was a one-sided consideration. With respect the discussion that was had about the costs of the election contests and whether directors would nominate somebody and then walk away and not support them. I would emphasize the nature of the error committed there was committed time and again. We counted 25 different places in the adopting release where the commission said that costs would go up or down, quote, to the extent that something happened, and then didn't follow up and attempt to determine the extent to which it would happen. And contrary to Mr.
They also went from 1 year to three, right? So which changed everything.
It did not change everything, but I suppose that if it did, it was their obligation to then go back and reassess those three-year holdings, which was something that they evidently did not do. To address the question of the union funds in particular, first of all, I believe it is elected state officials who have control over the state funds. This was not an ideological issue. This was not management against union. There were four different law professors who said this is a problem. Professor Grunfest, Professor Bainbridge, Roberta Romama has written on it, and Jonathan Macy. Finally, what we are talking about here are not simply errors in cost assessment. The problems that you discussed with Mr. Quinn go to the entire rationale of this rule, and as we put it in our brief, the agency just does not know what it has wrought. It does not understand how this rule will function. There are alternatives out there, and for all of these reasons and the reasons in our brief, this rule should be vacated.
Yeah, you timed it perfectly. I think it might be a good idea if we took a recess, since perhaps not exactly the same crowd will be interested in the environmental regulation as are interested in the business regulation. So give us a recess, and we'll return in 10 minutes or so.